Hi, this is Dana Stevens, Slate's movie critic, and I'm here with a Slate spoiler special on Up in the Air, the new Jason Reitman movie. In the studio with me today are Dan Coyce. Hello, Dan.
Hey, Dana.
Who is a blogger for New York Magazine's Vulture blog, also writes for True Slant, and writes film reviews for The Washington Post. Have I covered it all?
And also, I have a book coming out.
Oh, yes, please plug your book.
Called Facing Future for Continuum's 33 and a Third series of music criticism about the Hawaiian musician Israel Kamakawiwa'ole.
I can't wait to see that, because I love those 33 and a Third books. They're like little monographs, right? I mean, it's a short little thing.
They're adorable little books about individual albums.
And can you explain just briefly who the Hawaiian musician is?
He's the guy who sings that version of Somewhere Over the Rainbow, What a Wonderful World, accompanied by the ukulele that you've heard in 10,000 movies.
Oh my God, that's great.
That's a great person to write a monograph about. I love it. And also joining me today in the studio is John Swansburg. Hello, John.
Hey, good to be here.
Slate's culture editor. And so, we all saw the movie in the last few days, and I wanted to start off with you, John, because you had this observation about this remarkable up-in-the-air phenomenon where your enjoyment of the movie dropped precipitously the day after seeing it, that I think you and I both had a really good time in the movie.
Yeah, we walked out and we were both pretty elated, I thought. Yeah, in the immediate aftermath of having seen it, I was very pleased. Throughout the viewing experience, I found it enjoyable. Although I did even in the movie start to feel it was a little bit too long. And then the next day when I woke up, I sort of felt more strongly that maybe there was almost 25 or 30 minutes that I'd have been okay without having seen. And there were certain moments that still felt pleasing to me in my memory. But there were the movie just hadn't held up over the course of my night of sleep, which was sort of disappointing.
Right,
it's strangely insubstantial in that way. Do you agree, Dan?
Yeah, I do. I saw it about a week and a half ago, and I found that big chunks of it have sort of evaporated from my memory. I mean, I don't even remember liking them or not liking them. They're just like big gaping holes. I sort of compare it to the way that when you walk through an airport, it's a not unpleasing, smooth phenomenon, but you don't remember it the next day. And big chunks of the movie had disappeared from my memory in the same way.
Well, okay, despite our collective amnesia, can we do some sort of plot summary of this movie?
I think George Clooney is in it.
I do remember Clooney.
Yeah. Sure, I'll do a plot summary if you hand me your press notes so I can remember everyone's character names. That's another thing that has disappeared from all our memories. I mean, they don't.
They're sort of bland names.
Right, their names are intentionally bland. All right, so George Clooney plays Ryan Bingham, who is a corporate downsizer. He flies everywhere around the country to do the firing of bosses who are too chicken to do it themselves. He lives up in the air, as he tells people. He is most happy when he's in transit. He's an expert at packing his bag perfectly. He knows the best ways to get through frequent flyer, through security lines and to use his frequent flyer cards. And he's approaching exalted, what is it, like 5 million, 10 million?
10 million, yeah.
10 million mile status on his airline of choice. His way of life, of course, is threatened when bright-eyed and bushy-tailed young executive is brought into his Omaha-based company, Natalie, who's played by Anna Kendrick, who has the bright idea that instead of firing people in person, they should just be firing people by Skype, which is true. They should be. I mean, the one of the problems with the movie is that that's an inarguable, like, business point. Like, there's no reason they should be firing anyone anyway other than by Skype. Or by phone call, if possible. Ryan takes Natalie out to learn the ropes of firing people so that she can eventually make him obsolete. Along the way, he meets sort of his doppelganger, his female doppelganger, played by Vera Farmiga, who's named Alex, who is, like him, a corporate road warrior on the road as often as him. They have a great meet cute scene where they compare frequent flyer programs in an airport bar, things proceed from there.
Yeah, I wanted to comment on that meet cute scene because I feel like it raised the hopes really high for the movie in a way that was never met again. There's kind of a screwball tone at the beginning of the movie. There's a great snappy opening montage with George Clooney's voiceover as he's describing all of his travel tricks, and you see him going through the airport and, you know, how he packs his bag and everything. And of course, Clooney is perfectly cast as this kind of, you know, this no strings attached guy who lives in the air, right? In fact, it actually figures a lot into the movie that we know that George Clooney himself is this perpetual bachelor who has vowed that he'll never get married. Doesn't George Clooney have a bet with some other star? I was trying to remember this during the movie. It's either Tilda Swinton or Meryl Streep or someone. He's bet them some huge amount of money that he'll never get married.
But he has been married once.
Oh, he has?
To Talia Balsam, yeah, who played Mona Sterling in Mad Men.
Was it back in the day? Back
yeah,
in
like
his ER days?
You should look. Everyone should look up pictures of him like shortly after being married from like the mid 90s. His hair is unbelievable. And Talia Balsam's the image that comes up on Google image search is really worth looking at. Talia Balsam's wearing this great see through polka dot blouse. But that's neither here nor there. But I think you're right that I think after that marriage dissolved, I think he does have some kind of bet about not getting hitched again.
I did not know about Talia, but you've got some deep background on your George Clooney gossip.
Well, it's more maybe
someone's got a man crush.
Yeah, I actually have more of a crush on Talia Balsam. I actually also have a man crush on George Clooney.
So, what does it say about the movie that we cannot even keep our discussion about it from being derailed? Like here, where it's our job to discuss this movie.
Well, but it's actually true that George Clooney's star power and the power of his personality is a big part of what makes this movie so charming. Oh, so I was
it's also
say
a problem. I think we can return to that, but I think it's what part of what makes the movie work and part of what made it didn't work for me too. Like there's scenes late in the movie when he goes home to his family that he sort of abandoned that I felt where I thought the movie kind of fell apart, in part because I just did not believe that George Clooney was sort of had been issued forth from this milieu.
But, right.
He certainly had never set forth in northern Wisconsin in his life.
No.
He certainly was not born there.
No, absolutely not.
Right.
Yeah, that's the second – we should mention that second plot of the movie, which is actually pretty key, but again, it's something that's like evaporated in the 2 days since seeing it. But he has this sister played by Melanie Lynskey who's about to get married in Minnesota, Wisconsin?
It's northern Wisconsin.
Northern Wisconsin, yeah.
And she has sent him this cardboard cutout of herself with her fiancé with the idea
Danny
that –
played by Danny McBride.
Played by Danny McBride. Very well, I thought. And he's supposed to be photographing this cutout in all the places he goes as kind of a gag gift for the wedding. And so there's this ongoing – the movie's kind of punctuated by these photographs of the cutout in front of various structures. And then he converges. He and Alex, the meet-cute female equivalent of him, end up going to this wedding together. So that's sort of the soft side of the story, the B-plot.
Right.
Well, and it's – as you say, as both of you have said, the star power of George Clooney drives this, but it also does define the movie in some way in that there's an essential tastefulness to George Clooney and to the kinds of movies that he chooses. And this is sort of like the epitome of the modern-day George Clooney movie in that it is extremely well-written and impeccably put together, and his performance is just right. I mean, it's as just right as that bag that Ryan Bingham packs every day before he gets on a plane. But it certainly has no sort of wildness or edge to it in a way that George Clooney at this point sort of has no wildness or edge to him. His taste is so good that I sort of feel like it's worth wondering if that is becoming an impediment to his career. I don't get the impression that George Clooney would ever do something I'm trying to think of like recent great, great movies that I just can't see George Clooney doing. Like he would never do something as sort of rough as even like Brokeback Mountain, or he would never be in Chicago, or it's good or bad movies that you really remember, I feel like, have some kind of ruggedness or dirtiness or ugliness about them, as well as the smooth, polished surface. And I feel like his movies have become all smooth, polished surface.
I don't hold that against him, that he's the Cary Grant of our day. Somebody's got to do it.
I feel like he did. Syriana is a movie that, was not that old, that sort of had a roughness to it, that, he was willing to sort of look crappy, and that movie sort of, its politics were pretty, I guess they're George Clooney's politics, but they're still, right. it wasn't like a burnished kind of, the politics of this movie is like, oh, downsizing is really hard on people. I mean, this movie kind of plays into, into the zeitgeist in a way that I think it would be hard for anyone to sort of disagree with.
Well, to me, it feels a little bit like it piggybacked on the zeitgeist.
Yeah.
Right. Well, it clearly was, the book was written before the downturn, and the movie was greenlit before the downturn, and it certainly seems as though, and you can't blame Jason Reitman for this, but, and this maybe can work into our discussion of Jason Reitman, but he definitely made the decision while filming that he needed to make this more quote unquote relevant.
Right.
And that's why he cast, there's several montages throughout the movie and several scenes throughout the movie that are in which the roles of employees being downsized are played by recently downsized employees from St. Louis, I think, and Chicago.
Or Detroit, I think.
Detroit,
also.
Yeah. And like I like that choice in theory, but in practice it does make the movie seem as though it is piggybacking in some way. And when the movie doesn't exactly have anything to say necessarily about what it is like to be downsized, it does make it feel a little bit opportunistic.
I felt like those people seemed a little bit like, you know, creatures in the zoo or something, especially when there would be a long montage of these really heartbreaking stories from these real people who had been downsized, and then the last one of them would suddenly be J.K. Simmons,
right,
and then
or
it would
Galifianakis.
Segue into a scene in which, you know, an actor was playing the part.
Right. They really felt, for that reason, they felt very shoehorned into the movie, and it's quite jarring to both go from, you know, actual downsized person to Zach Galifianakis, and then you sort of the next cut is to George Clooney's beautiful face, and you're just sort of it's quite jarring and not in the way that I think it's intended to be.
Yes, as listeners to any Slate podcast know, we're sponsored by Audible.com, which is the leading provider of audio entertainment on the web. They have well over 60,000 great titles, including the book Up in the Air, on which this movie was based. It's by Walter Kern. I'm in the middle of reading the novel now, and actually I'll venture to say that I like it a lot better than the movie. It's definitely darker and edgier and far more of a corporate satire than the movie is. And also seems so far, I'm only about, a third of the way through or something, it seems to be less focused on this Vera Farmiga romance character because she hasn't really emerged yet. It's really a lot more about sort of business speak, you know, which is what this guy sort of thinks and writes it.
I'm under the impression that the Vera Farmiga character was in fact invented for the movie.
I'm not sure. There is an Alex in the book, but okay. So far she's nothing like the Vera Farmiga character. So you can listen to Up in the Air unabridged on Audible. It's read by Sean Ronette, and that's our Audible recommendation for the week. And so, as you know, if you've listened to a spoiler podcast in the past year, we have a deal with Audible where you can sign up, get a free book with your sign up, and get a free book per month thereafter. And you can keep that free book even if you don't decide to keep your membership, which of course you will. And the place to do that is www.audiblepodcast.com/spoiler. So let's talk a little bit about Jason Reitman, the director of this movie. It's his third film. His first movie was Thank You for Smoking, which I thought was a wildly overpraised corporate satire. And his second movie was Juno, which, you know, everybody sort of knows the ascent of Juno. And now this movie. I've had the feeling from minute one of this movie that it's going to do very well in awards season because it has that tone that I sort of think of as the new tone that's needed to garner as many awards as possible, which, as you were saying, Dan, is sort of inoffensive. It's sort of like the kind of movie that nobody can't love, but nobody can really feel passionate about either. I feel like Slumdog Millionaire sort of had that. Little Miss Sunshine sort of had it. And I like those movies. I like things about them. But there's something crowd-pleasing about them where it's sort of like you can take grandma. And that kind of movie has been cleaning up recently at awards. Do you guys have that feeling too?
Yes. Well, I mean, the combination of accidental zeitgeist yet an ability to be absolutely inoffensive about a major issue, I think also is going to lend it a lot of weight in awards season. And the fact that, as you guys said, while you're watching it, it's a totally pleasurable process. And I mean, I think awards voters spend the months of December and January jamming in 2 to 3 movies a day. And so everything evaporates from their minds. So all they remember of any movie is how they felt while they were watching it. And so a movie like this makes a much greater impression when you're watching 3 movies a day than it does for the average film goer who's going to see it, like it, and then forget about it, unlike other movies that may stick in their memories more.
And this movie is really enjoyable. I mean, maybe we've undersold its enjoyableness to some degree. I mean, there are moments that are really fun. We started to talk about the meet cute scene, and we kind of got derailed. I mean, that scene is really fun. I mean, when Ryan and Alex meet in the bar and they start, you know, whipping out their various frequent flyer cards, it's really quite funny. And there's a great crackle between those two actors throughout the movie.
Oh yeah, they're utterly smoking
scene,
together.
There's an amazing scene where at one point they're both on business travel but in different cities, and they're both in their robes in different, you know, Hilton Garden Inns and anonymous American cities, and they have this great text message flirtation that, you know, text messaging, or I actually think they're BBMing, which seemed actually even more accurate.
What's BBMing?
It's BlackBerry Messenger. Mm-hmm. And it seemed perfect that they would be BBMing, and they have this like really ribald exchange about, you know, they're sort of having like BBM sex, and it was really well written and seemed quite like exactly the kind of tawdry thing you would say over BlackBerry Messenger if you were having that kind of relationship with someone. I thought it was really admirable. I thought that's the kind of thing that I think movies often get wrong.
Right.
But there are lots of great moments like that throughout the movie that were very fun that I do remember. There's just other parts of it that sort of were more effervescent.
Right. And I mean, I'll say honestly that I thought all three of the leads actually were pretty outstanding and had pretty great chemistry. I mean, I really liked Anna Kendrick, who played Natalie, the younger efficiency expert. I liked her character a lot. I liked her rapport with George Clooney, and I love the way that every time she talked to Vera Farmiga, she just would accidentally insult her so many times. Like, yeah. She just, you know, what doesn't she say at one point, like, you know, God, you're exactly what I hope I am in 20 years.
Right.
And you can see Vera Farmiga just blanch right. at the notion that she's 20 years older than Anna
And she
Kendrick.
Has another great line along the same lines where she says, you know, I just really want to thank, I don't want to say anything anti-feminist. I really appreciate all the stuff that your generation did for us, which is another great kind of back-headed
right.
And Vera Farmiga has great deadpan reactions in those scenes. And we should also note that Vera Farmiga is just, in addition to being utterly scorching hot, is really terrific in this movie.
Yeah,
and
she's
I
great.
Mean, she's, I hope she has a big career ahead of her. She's only just come onto the radar in the last, since The Departed, I guess, in the last few years. But
although,
she's really wonderful, and she really stands up. She really gives George Clooney, you know, gives it right back to him.
I agree. She was terrific. Although maybe we should, since this is a spoiler, maybe we should discuss the sort of major spoilerific
yeah,
thing
we
that
have
happens
to spoil
because
that.
That's one problematic part of the movie, and it involves her. So major spoiler alert. This is I guess the one big surprise in the movie, other than the fact that George Clooney does get to 10 million miles.
And that young MC is in it.
Yes, that was very fun. But at the end of so throughout the movie, we sort of do understand that Ryan, the George Clooney character, and Alex are sort of doppelgangers. That they both are these corporate. Travel types who don't have homes and sort of live in hotels and in airplanes and airports.
And she says to him at one point, I'm you, but with a vagina, right? That's like one of her pickup lines.
Right, exactly. That she says that very explicitly. And she is actually the one of the two of them who's always saying, All I want is a relationship where if we both happen to be laying over in Denver, that we will sleep together. Like, she doesn't want anything more than that. She's no strings attached. And then towards the end of the movie, of course, Ryan, the Clooney character, does start to feel stronger affection for her, and he sort of ditches a corporate talk that he's giving and sort of runs off to
Chicago. Super cliched moment. Like, do not run through an airport at the end of a romantic comedy.
Yeah.
Just don't do it.
Also, don't start a speech and then say you can't finish it.
Right.
That was painful.
Which is so not his character. His character would not start a corporate speech that he'd been paid some shitload of money to do.
And that he'd been looking forward to do his whole life. Like, it was posited as like this particular great Vegas, you know, junket that he'd always wanted to do.
Oh, also, yeah, Gold Quest 20?
Yeah, double Eckies. They also just, it didn't make any sense. Like, why did he have to run to Chicago? Like, there wasn't anything he was trying to make in particular.
Right.
He could have easily finished the talk. I mean, he's like an expert traveler. He could have caught, he's going to Chicago, the easiest place to travel to in America. Anyway, he goes to Chicago and, he runs up to her brownstone in Lincoln Park or wherever and, knocks on the door and is hoping to have some, you know, maybe confess his real love to her. And she opens the door and she has this kind of stricken look on her face. And he's confused for a moment, and then we sort of see her two little kids like running around in the background and her husband asking, you know, who is it? And it turns out she's not really him. She does travel all the time, but in fact she has a home that she goes back to, and she has a husband and kids, and she sort of says, you shouldn't be here. And ultimately they have a phone conversation. She says that, you know, he broke the rules by coming to see her at her home.
I thought that denouement was handled really lamely because,
yeah.
I mean, those characters have been pretty well drawn, and the fact that they have these characteristics, you know, that he's enough of a perfectionist that he would have finished the Goal Quest speech,
right?
And that also, I mean, all along they've been sort of having these great – this is when the screwball tone dropped away, and it made
right.
me sad. They've been having these great screwball verbal jousts the whole time, and then he discovers this huge thing that she's been keeping from him, right? And he's already taken her to the wedding, the sister's wedding, so they've sort of had, like, their sappy moment
yeah.
where it's kind of obvious that it could be more than just the layover kind
right.
of
not just him. I mean, she seems to be falling for him as well.
So actually, I do think it was a big ethical lapse that she didn't tell him about that. And but yet the conversation that they have later, I don't know, I just felt like it really betrayed, you know, what little verisimilitude their relationship had built up at that point.
Right. She was saying that he had broken the rules, when in fact it was clearly that if anyone had broken the rules, it had been her. I mean, Clooney had been up front with her throughout about what his lifestyle was, and she was the one who'd been dissembling.
But the movie wants us to think, see, this is, I think, where the movie kind of cops out at the end. The movie wants us to think this thing that I think Oscar voters are going to love to think, which is sort of like, it's all about human connection in the end, you know, it's a moral trajectory that George Clooney traces where he learns to love or whatever.
Right.
And I didn't think that denouement of their love story actually did teach you that. Right.
Right? Yeah. It didn't really follow. But then what happens after that is that, yeah, we do get these kind of two moments where George Clooney is obviously a changed man. He takes some of like a million of his bonus miles and he gives them to his sister so that she can have a honeymoon because, you know, she doesn't have the means that he does. And there's this great scene where Natalie character has left the downsizing firm and is applying for jobs in San Francisco. And Clooney has written a letter of recommendation for her. And that's also meant to sort of show, like, like his humanity and the fact that he's come around to, you know, the idea of helping others and helping in particular this woman, Natalie, with whom he's had a fraught relationship. And I thought there was kind of a funny moment because like we see this letter of recommendation and it's supposed to be this like big moment where Clooney has finally come around to helping his fellow man. It's like not such a great letter of recommendation. It's like barely a paragraph long and it's just like you should hire this girl. There's no details. Like if I were a hirer, I don't think I'd be so impressed by that letter.
Right. Unless I was like an enormous fan of Ryan Bingham, the human being, where I'd be like, oh, Ryan Bingham.
Right, right. But he's some anonymous guy.
Right.
It didn't make any sense, but...
Right. So I guess what we can all agree is that this is a movie that sets everything up perfectly and then like in its last 20 minutes basically throws away almost everything that had happened previously. I mean, while maintaining pretty expertly its smoothness of tone and professionalness of assembly, it does in the end sort of undercut what limited messages it seemed to be offering in the first place.
Do you
I agree.
Think it implies at the end, the last shot we see is George Clooney standing looking at the board, you know, at another airport looking for his flight. Is it implied that even though he's sort of gone through a Christmas Carol experience and now he's going to buy the goose for the poor child or whatever, that he is going to remain this person without human connection who's always up in the air?
I don't know. He lets go of the rolling luggage. I don't know if that was meant to be, you know, he was just symbolically letting go of that lifestyle or whether he just was letting go of the luggage. It was ambiguous to me.
Right. Well, such is the acting style of George Clooney that one is often forced to search, like, the things that his hands do or the things that he lets go or just the shots themselves for any clues to what's going on.
See, I think you're more anti-Clooney than me and John are because I actually thought I love him and I love the choices that he's made in his career. It's true he's not the edgiest, most adventurous actor, but I love the spot that he fills. I think he's such a throwback to an old Hollywood style. And I actually thought he had some moments of vulnerability in this movie that did take him outside of the Danny Ocean, you know, complete slick package.
I agree. And one of my favorite scenes in the whole movie and a scene, I think, in which he does that is so he does reach this 10 million mile mark, which is what he's sort of been going for with American Airlines. And apparently there's – I don't know if this is real or not. I'm sort of curious. But you know, there are only six people in the history of the world who've flown 10 million miles on American. And he's sort of at the end of the movie when he's had these kind of revelations about his lifestyle and thinking about maybe changing it, he sort of has forgotten where he is in his mile mark. And they're flying over Dubuque or someplace. And the stewardess comes over the phone or the PA and says that, oh, you know, we have a special announcement. This guy has just crossed the 10 million mile mark, and in a great cameo, Sam Elliott comes out and he plays the pilot.
And he's almost the wreathed
chief pilot.
In,
of
the chief pilot.
American Airlines.
Yeah,
he looks fantastic. He's like wreathed in this nimbus of light as he comes out, so you almost think it's a dream sequence.
Exactly. Yeah, it was really really great, and he was perfectly cast. It's sort of like the he was great, but. It's the moment that the Clooney character has been waiting for all his professional life, and it doesn't have the meaning for him that he thought it would. And he tells the pilot that, you know, he's dreamt about this moment and what he would say and what he would ask the pilot, but he can't. It does, like, he can't remember at that moment what he wanted to say or what he was supposed to feel. And I thought that Clooney, you know, I mean, within the confines of this movie, it was an impressive change in tone for him.
Right, and it is, you know, it is. I think within the confines of the movie is the exact right thing to say, which is that I'm actually, despite everything I've said, I'm actually extremely pro-Clooney, and I, too, am really happy about the role that he fills and the movies that he causes to get made, because most of the good George Clooney movies that get made would have never gotten made if he hadn't attached himself to them. And within the confines of this movie, he does give basically the perfect performance. It's just that sometimes I wish that he chose movies that had broader confines, I guess.
Yeah, it's true. That's actually, I was just going to say he just made the movie Fantastic Mr. Fox, but he made it by being absolutely George Clooney
right,
in every
right,
second.
Right.
All right, well, thank you guys so much for joining me for this Slate spoiler special.
Thanks, Dana.
Thank you.
For Slate.com, I'm Dana Stevens.